topic, and I tell everyone who calls or emails that after preparing this topic, after writing a book about the topic, I feel like I know less about the topic than when I started researching the topic. And if you think about it, it really is an impossible mission. You're trying to understand how God runs the world. So that is a topic that we approach with humility, and a lot of times we just end up with more questions than answers. So I'm going to try to put some sense to some ideas, but I think there's still going to be many, many questions that are unanswered. But that's what we try to do. We do our best, and we try to reach for the infinite, knowing that it's the infinite, and therefore we as finite beings will always fall short. But I wanted to open the night with a story. One of the reasons I actually wrote the book was to get away from stories, because so many books about divine providence are these fanciful stories, and usually when you see a book about the topic, it's just stories about I missed my flight, and because of that, this happened and that happened, and I wanted to try to analyze the topic. So I'm going to go against that, and I'm going to start with a story, because it's a Harrisburg divine providence story. So in the mid-70s, there was a young man who was not religious, and he had actually lived a little bit in Arizona. He was a skier, so he was in Arizona skiing. And he got into a bad skiing accident, and he wasn't able to ski. He hurt his shoulder. So he decided that he was going to take off some time from skiing. He didn't really have a choice. And he always wanted to read the Bible, not for religious reasons, but for literary reasons. He never really got a chance to go through the Bible. So he decided that he was going to take the Chumash, take the Bible, and read through the Bible that year while he was sitting out with his skiing injury. He decided that he started to have a lot of questions. There was no internet, obviously, in the 70s. So he looked up where is a congregation, where is a shul, a temple, whatever he could find that was Jewish in Arizona. And he found a conservative shul. He went there, started asking people questions. People didn't have the answers. They said, speak to the rabbi. Spoke to the rabbi. The rabbi had some answers. Other answers weren't pleasing him so much. And That's what was going on. He was in Arizona. A few months later, he got a phone call from his mother that his father was sick. They were from the East Coast. And his mother said, it's time for you to come back to the East Coast. Now, he didn't really want to live super close. He wanted to be close, but not too close. And he also wanted to continue skiing because he had finally, his shoulder was getting better. So he looked around at cities. What are some big cities close to the East Coast, close enough to skiing? He had gone to Penn State University, so he felt at home in Pennsylvania, and he chose Harrisburg. So he came to Harrisburg, and he was living downtown, working as an accountant, and he used to walk, he used to like walking. And one day he went for a walk uptown, and he was walking, I don't know the name of the street here, what's the name of the street?
Third Street.
He was walking on Third Street. It was getting dark, and it was snowing. And as he was walking, he noticed walking on the street, he saw on the street, excuse me, an elderly man who he later found out was in his upper 90s. I think his name was Mr. Hammer. And he was shoveling the snow. So, okay, I got the name right. Okay, Jack, right? Okay. I had to verify that his name was really Jack Hammer. Okay, so Mr. Hammer, how long has Mr. Hammer passed? Long time, okay. So Mr. Hammer was in his upper 90s, that makes sense, in the mid-70s?
In his 80s,
okay. So he was in his 80s, still an older age for shoveling snow, and this young man saw an older man shoveling snow, so he said, can I shovel for you? And Mr. Hammer said, sure. So he kept shoveling, finished shoveling the snow, and Mr. Hammer said, are you Jewish by any chance? And the young man said, yes, actually I am. He said, well, you know, we're about to daven mincha, and it's snowing. I'm really a little nervous we're not going to get a minyan. Would you mind staying for mincha? So he stayed, and he davened mincha and ma'ariv with them. Afterwards, a lot of people came over, introduced themselves in regular hospitality of Harrisburg, and they said, you know, tomorrow night, two nights from now, is Shabbos. Why don't you come for Shabbos? He said, okay. And they said, well, you know what? Why don't you sleep here? Because where you live, they asked where you lived. He lived all the way downtown. You're not going to be able to make the walk. Why don't you stay? So he was invited for a house for Shabbos. He spent a Friday night here and a Shabbos morning. He finally was getting some good answers to a lot of the questions that he had from his Bible reading. And they said, why don't you come back the next Shabbos? And he came back Shabbos after Shabbos, and he really took a liking to the community, and he began taking small steps towards living an Orthodox lifestyle. He was here for a little bit, and the community here told him that, you know, there aren't really girls here for you. It's time for you to get married. And they sent him to New York City to Rabbi Riskin's shul on the Upper West Side. He went to Rabbi Riskin's shul, waited online one day at the coat check, met a young lady. They went downstairs for some refreshments after the shiur. Fast forward a few months later, they got engaged. They got married. A bus came from Harrisburg to the wedding. And it was all because he had hurt his shoulder. His father got sick, ended up walking on the street, met Mr. Hammer, did a kind deed like Jews do. And because of that, I'm here today, because that man was my father. And Rabbi Friedman said, you know, he put Harrisburg on our list of travels. So growing up, I've never been to Harrisburg before, but growing up, Harrisburg has always been a name. My father's name is Marty Leibowitz. I don't know if anyone here was...
We talked to your dad.
Oh, okay.
On Friday.
Oh, very good. Okay. So, I got the story right?
You got the story right.
Okay, very good.
First time we ever heard it.
Oh, okay. So...
And the thing is, Rabbi Hammer's son will be here next week.
Oh, wow.
So Rabbi Hammer will be here next week.
Very
Jack
nice.
Hammer's grandson.
Jack Hammer's
grandson. Wow. So I think at that time, Rabbi Silver was an elderly man at the time. He was the rabbi in the shul. And my father was very taken with him as well. And he always speaks about the community here and the families. So I don't know how many of you were here in the 70s, but personally, I feel a very strong connection to Harrisburg. And that is why I was on the way here, we stopped and I took a picture at 110 Cumberland Street, because that is where my father was living at the time. So I came here to take a picture and send him a picture to let him know that I was admitted to Harrisburg.
Not to interrupt, but...
No, please.
But just to add a little piece of the story, besides that Rabbi Hammer is going to be next week, I told the story to Pinchas Fleischman, who also knew your dad and helped, and he said, the difference in a conservative shul and Kesherism and Orthodox shul is, conservative shul will say, we'd like to invite you, whereas a KI says, you're coming over to our house.
Right. He told me he sat 7 rows back. He told me to sit in the seat. I don't know if you daven in the main shul tomorrow morning, but he told me, find my seat 7 rows back from the front. And he said he came Shabbos after Shabbos. He said he would come week in and week out. And my father now has 5 children. 2 of us live in Israel, and lots of grandchildren. And my mother was also, at the time, my mother was brought up in a very secular home and actually became religious through studying for graduate classes in Jewish philosophy. Was very taken with Moses Mendelssohn, and then was very taken with Buber and Rosenzweig, and then was very taken by Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Cook, and eventually through studies became religious. They met each other and have lived in Teaneck since then. So that's my connection to Harrisburg.
You mentioned Karen Bayavna.
Yeah.
And Rabbi David Silver's son, Aaron, Rav Aaron Silver of Karen Bayavna.
Oh, I didn't realize. I know that there's Rabbi Silver and Karen Bayavna. I didn't realize the connection. Very nice. Okay, so I feel like that's a good introduction to be able to talk about. So I wasn't really planning on talking about the topic because, as I said, I feel like if you write a book about it, you're supposed to give like an amazing shiur about the topic. And I feel, like I said, that I'm still sort of treading for water in the topic. But Rabbi Friedman said, why don't you speak about the topic? So I said, wow, if, you know, with I was going to tell the story anyway. But certainly if the topic is Hashgacha Pratis, so we have to talk about the topic. Okay. So we're talking about divine providence. And the Ramban writes that belief in divine providence really includes two different beliefs. One is a belief that God knows everything that's going on. And the Ramban writes that for a person to deny such a thing, that God knows everything, that's pretty egregious, because that's we sort of put that on the list of things that God can do, is that he knows everything that's going on. But the concept of divine providence is not just about God believing. but it's also that God interacts in the world. He knows, but he also interacts. And the Ramban writes that the question of his interaction, to deny that is not necessarily so egregious. One could make the argument that God is so holy and we're so lowly, why would he get involved in our mundane pedestrian lives? God is much holier than that. He has much more holy and important things to do. Why would he get involved in my little life? And this is something that we proclaim when we daven Hallel. We say, Mi kashem Elokeinu, who's like God? Hamagbi lashoves, hamashvili liros bashamayim v'aretz. Even though he dwells up on high, he lowers himself to see what goes down here on earth. And that's one of our praises of God, that despite his greatness, right, we can all relate to this. You have a big business with a big, you know, Forbes 500 CEO. He's not taking his time to speak to the janitors or to the receptionists. He's too busy in his ivory tower. And that's one of our praises of God, that despite his greatness, he lowers himself to interact with us mundane people and get involved in our lives in a very personal and intimate way. And this is the belief in Hashgacha Pratis. This is our faith that we are not just mindlessly, we're not just a bunch of simple people walking around without any connection, any relationship to God or to anything that's great and deep and special, but that Hashem interacts with us on a very personal and intimate level. The question, though, is to what degree? When do I look at things that happen in my life and say, this is from God? And when do I say, this is nature? I stubbed my toe because I wasn't being careful. This has nothing to do with God. Why should I blame God for my own lack of attention to the uneven pavement on the sidewalk? So this is the question that I'm not going to have a good answer for, but we're going to try at least to scratch. We're going to do some source analysis. I hope that that's okay. We're going to do some source analysis, and let's see what we can come up with. So on the one hand, when we look at the Gemara, when we look at the Talmud, so the Gemara seems to be pretty clear and to take a strong stance on this question. The first source, are there people have source sheets? So the first source is the Gemara in Maseches Chulin. Amar Rabbi Chanina, Ein Adam Nokef Etzbo Milmata, Ella Imkein Machrizin Alav Milmalu. A person does not stub his toe unless it was so declared in heaven. Shenemar Me'ashem Mitzadei Gaber, that it's from Hashem that man steps. That's one Gemara. Another Gemara is talking about suffering, and it goes through what is the extent of suffering, and it gives all different examples. You stick your hand in your pocket to take out 3 coins, and you only take out 2 coins. Lots of very small, trivial things. And how much time does it take to stick your hand back in the pocket and take out another coin? Small, trivial things. That's what the Gemara says. And many of the Rishonim, many of the medieval commentators take their cues from this Gemara, and they argue that everything that happens to a person is divinely ordained. Everything that happens to a person. The Rambam writes this way in his Guide of the Perplexed, in Mor Nevuchim. He writes that things that happen to a person are divine providence. If something happens, it's from God. The Sefer Achinuch, maybe we'll read one passage here. He's speaking here, I believe in this context, I think he's talking, I don't remember exactly actually which mitzvah he's talking about here, but the Sefer HaChinuch says as follows. Why do we have this mitzvah? Likboa b'nafshosenu, in order to establish in our hearts, in our minds, ki hashkochas Hashem Baruch Hu pratis al kol echad v'echad mibnei Adam. It's individualistic for each person. And then he says, maybe I'll read in the English. There are groups of people who think that the providence of God is over all species on a specific level, both humans and other living creatures, animals. The Rambam writes this. The Rambam says that there are some people who think that when a spider kills a specific fly, it's because that fly had it coming to him. And God set up that fly to come into this spider's web. Says the Rambam, that's not correct. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, that's not correct. There are those who think that. There are other groups that think that God's providence is over all things in the world, not only living creatures, but even inanimate creatures, objects, to the extent that they think that when one leaf falls from a tree, God decreed that it should fall. But he says this view is very logical. He then says that there are those who think that there is no providence at all. However, last paragraph, according to what I have heard, we bearers of the true faith believe that his providence is over all species of living creatures in a general sense. There are a certain number of cows that need to exist in the world, and therefore God overlooks the species in general. But specific cows don't have God's providence. But regarding the human species, we believe that God's providence is over everyone individually. This approach we've received from great thinkers, and many verses attest to the accuracy of this approach. So this is the standard view when you look in the writings of the Rishonim, the medieval commentators, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Sefer HaChinuch. Many of them write along these lines that divine providence is specific, individualistic when you're dealing with the human species. However, when you're dealing with anything else in the world, animals, inanimate objects, there's no divine providence. Now, there is one interesting caveat that is suggested by some of these writers. What would you say about the following case? A cow grazing in the field, trips, falls, breaks its leg, and dies. Divine providence or not? According to what we've seen, what would you say? No. But what if that cow... Go ahead.
Could that be a punishment to the owner of
the cow? Oh, excellent. I was just going to say, what if that cow is the only cow of a farmer who has 7 children, no other means of supporting himself except for the milk that he gets from the cow every day and sells in the market? So now is that divine providence? Well, is that really divine providence on a cow? Or is that divine providence on a person? So there's a funny medrash, and we know that many midrashim are not literal, but they're there to teach something. They're there to educate us about something. So the medrash tells a story of a fable, of a scorpion that really wanted to cross the Susquehanna River. But he had no ferry. He had no way to get across the river. But to his luck, a frog happened to show up, and the frog said, "Jump on my back, and I'll take you across the river." So the frog took the scorpion across the river, and God arranged for the frog to bring the scorpion across the river. The scorpion went and bit someone, and the person died. And the Rishonim all quote this medrash, not that it's a literal story, but it's to teach something, that God sometimes interacts with inanimate or animals because there's some type of ramification for people. And that would be an important caveat when we say that animals do not get divine providence. That's only if we're talking about animals that have no connection to people. So this is the view that was really the accepted view in the times of the Talmud, in the times of medieval commentators. This was the view that was accepted. However, when you get to the 17th century and the writings of the Kabbalists start to become much more publicized, and when you start certainly with the Hasidic movement, so you start to see many writers writing that everything in creation is divine providence. Animals, inanimate objects. The view that the Chinuch said is illogical. The view that the Rambam argued on, all of a sudden you find in a lot of Jewish philosophic writings that this view, what I would call the expansive view of divine providence, starts to become very, very popular. They do find a source for it in a much earlier text, a Medrash, which goes back to Mishnaic or Talmudic times at least. And the Medrash is a very interesting story. I will actually just add one point before we go on. This idea that all human beings get divine providence, there is another question we might want to ask, which is, well, do all human beings merit the same level of divine providence? So here also we find that many of the writers suggest that part of the degree of divine providence that a person receives is, to a degree, how much a person is dedicated to the mission for why he was created. If a person, and they suggest that part of the whole idea of divine providence is that God interacts in our lives because God has a mission for us. And God, we have a partnership with God. And therefore, the Rambam and the Ramban, both of them write that to the degree that a person is involved in a Torah lifestyle, in mitzvos, so Hashem interacts with him or her in commensurate to the degree that they're involved in their mission. And they quote Psukim about how the tzaddik receives extra special protection from Hashem because of the mission that he has dedicated himself to. But again, it's only for people, not for animals. But again, when we get to the Hasidic literature and Kabbalistic literature, you start to find this very expansive view of divine providence. And there's a very interesting medrash that they base it on. It's on the second side of the source sheet. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai and Rabbi Elazar, we know that the great Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai had to hide in a cave for many years because of the Romans. So he was there with his son. So they were hiding in a cave for 13 years during a period of persecution. And they sustained themselves by eating inferior dried out carob until their skin became dried out and cracked. After 13 years, they exited and sat at the entrance of the cave. They saw a hunter hunting birds. When Rabbi Shimon would hear a heavenly voice declare, he was perceptive to heavenly voices. When he would hear the words, free, free, the bird would escape from the hunter's trap. And then when he would hear the voice declare, death, the bird would be trapped and captured. Rabbi Shimon saw this, and he proclaimed that these heavenly voices teach that even a bird isn't captured without a decree from heaven. How much more so the life of a person. Now, the next two sources on the sheet, I won't read them inside, I'll let you read them. The next two sources on the sheet point at this medrash, and they say, you see from here that the Rambam is wrong. You see from here that the sources we've seen until now are wrong. Why? Because what do you see in this medrash? The bird is captured because of God's decree. You see that even animals receive divine providence. This is their argument. Now, can anyone deflect their argument, please?
Well, because the hunter needs the food. Hunter's hunting and...
Right, so first of all, the divine providence here perhaps is for the hunter. Although I might argue and say, well, he doesn't need this specific bird. We don't need a godly decree on this bird to go free. Then the next bird comes. Right? It sounds like there's all these birds there pecking away at the food. One bird, God says, free, and the bird flies away. And other birds, God says, death, and the bird gets captured. But I agree with the direction you're going in, and there are commentaries on the Medrash that suggest what you're saying. I would give another, a similar argument. Anyone can make a similar argument to try to deflect this proof? Anyone? Maybe there's another human being in the story that is being impacted by the divine providence. Who's that? Anyone? Oh, the owner of the bird. But it sounds like they're wild birds. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Remember, he was in the cave. And he sees this event, and what does he conclude? Oh, well, if birds are only trapped because of God's decree, how much more so humans? So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, now it doesn't tell us in the Medrash, but it could be that this is perhaps what... We know he was only in the cave for 13 years. Maybe it's this story, because it says he was there already for 13 years. So the story is contemporaneous to when he left the cave. Why did he choose to leave the cave after 13 years? It could be because of this story. He saw that it's only when God decrees that a bird should be captured, that a bird is captured. So he said, you know what? Maybe it's time for me to come out.
So God changes his theology in order to get him to leave.
So I would say that this is not really divine providence on the bird. This is divine providence on Rav Shimon bar Yochai.
So Hashem is teaching him the wrong way.
Because he's showing it through an animal.
No, yeah, he's showing it through an animal. So you see, it's the wrong Kal v'chomer. You shouldn't be making it.
I hear what you're saying. Maybe that's where these sources are coming from. Okay, good. That's a good point. I like that suggestion.
This is a little out there. When I think about the ecosystem, I think about the balance in nature. And I don't know if this is really an example of divine providence. I mean, this certainly is a macro level rather than the individual or micro level, but you have to maintain that balance. Certain animals eat other animals.
Excellent.
Human beings.
I want you to stop because what you're saying is excellent, and I think I'm going to be there in a minute, so I'm going to shake your hands. I think I agree very much with what you're saying. And if you're saying something different, then I'm going to let you finish the point. So I'm going to come back to that in 1 second. No, I think what you're saying is excellent, and I want to get there in 1 minute. So what we want to do is we want to see if we can bridge. You know, we could say, and And I see from Rabbi Friedman's topics in the shul that Rabbi Friedman has a sensitivity towards Jewish philosophy and Jewish thought. So it looks like that's the nature of some of the shiurim that are given here. So as you know then, it could very well be that we just have a dispute here. And there were different time periods, and maybe the influence of Kabbalah influenced some writers. What I'd like to do is I'd like to suggest some bridges. I'm not arguing that they don't disagree. It could be that we just have a big dispute here about how divine providence works. And as I mentioned, we're trying to figure out how God runs the world. So it makes sense that there are going to be different views, and no one's going to have absolute proof and be able to say, you know, QED, this is how God runs the world. But I would like to at least give some directions of thought that could at least begin to bridge some of these different perspectives. There is an amazing statement, maybe just to highlight the problem. There was a great Hasidic writer, teacher, named Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Peshitta. Now, he doesn't fit the classic mold of a Hasidic Rebbe. Why? Because when we usually think of a Hasidic Rebbe, we think of what we refer to as Amunah Pshuta, simple faith, don't get too sophisticated with all the philosophizing, just believe, let's dance, let's sing, let's be besimcha. Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Peshitta gave lectures in Jewish philosophy. He taught Mor Nevuchim. Now, just the guide of the perplexed. There are some Hasidic circles where they joke and they say that the Mor Nevuchim in their library is bound on both sides. They bind the book on both sides because they don't open that book. He gave lectures on it, and he gave regular shiurim on Mor Nevuchim. So he was an interesting person. And they tell a story of him walking in the fields with his students, and he leans down on the ground, and he picks up a piece of hay, and he holds it to his students, and he says, anyone who believes that this piece of hay is not here because God decreed it to be here at this moment is a heretic. Now, that is a very strong statement. First of all, that's the H word, and we try not to use the H word unless it's absolutely necessary. But in addition to that, he taught the Mor Nevuchim. The Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim that inanimate objects do not get divine providence. So what he's calling the Rambam heretic, he gave lectures in the Rambam's philosophic work. So there's got to be some type of bridge here. So I'd like to suggest a couple of directions. One, your name?
Barry.
I think might be the direction that Barry was going in. And I'm not an expert in this field, but there is a whole field of thought, chaos theory. And there is a whole field of thought, we refer to it many times more colloquially, as the butterfly effect. And the butterfly effect argues that a butterfly flapping its wings in Peru can influence the weather in California. Because there's a very balanced ecosystem, weather, scientific systems that are at play in the world. And a slight little change here, for all we know, can have drastic ramifications, can cause a hurricane in Miami because of some one small thing. So a great Hasidic rabbi, the Sanzer Rav, he suggested, because he subscribed to this Hasidic view, but he had a problem. How can we Hasidim argue that everything is divinely ordained or divine providence if the Rambam, all of the Gemara, all of these great rabbis said only human beings? So he said, basically, and this is before the butterfly effect was popular. He wrote in the late 1700s, early 1800s, he wrote that it could be that really all divine providence is only for humans. We Hasidim don't disagree with what the earlier writers said, but we accept the caveat that whenever something influences a human, that's not called divine providence on an animal, that's called divine providence on a human. And you know what? Everything that happens to every animal and every tree in the world has an influence on mankind. Because when a tree falls in a forest, it does make a noise if you subscribe to chaos theory and the butterfly effect. And therefore, what he basically argued was that divine providence is only for human beings. But everything that occurs in the world is connected to mankind. And therefore, there is divine providence on everything. Not necessarily directly to the inanimate object, but because of mankind. And this was his suggestion, the Sanzer Rav, Rabbi Chaim of Sanz. And again, I checked it. It's as good as what Wikipedia says, But this was around 50 or 60 years before chaos theory and the butterfly effect was known. Was this? It's really like five lines in his writings. I want to just give one other perspective, and I'll end with this. One other perspective to, again, to bridge a little bit, to see... Was that the direction you were going in? Okay, good. I thought so. Okay. So a different perspective that I think also can bridge a little bit. It doesn't necessarily contradict the view that we just suggested, but it's a different way of looking at things. Rabbi Moshe Chaim of Luzzatto, the author of some very famous works, the Mesilas Yesharim, The Path of the Just, Derech Hashem, great Jewish thinker, lived in the 1700s, was very controversial in his time. I believe he was excommunicated or was about to be excommunicated from Padua in Italy, I believe is where he was from. And he had to escape, he had to move because he was a controversial figure in his time. He wrote works, it's, you know, funny, some of the people who were the most controversial in history end up being some of the most central figures in Jewish thought. The Rambam, we know, was very controversial at his time, and now is you know the meat and potatoes of any yeshiva student. And so the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim of Luzzatto, was a similar figure, and he was controversial at his time. One of the reasons was that he didn't have a beard, and he was teaching Kabbalah, and he was living in a culture where it was accepted that if you were a big rabbi, you had a beard, and he didn't have a beard, and he was teaching Kabbalah to the masses, which was also not popular at those times. And he says the following. He writes, this is his theory based obviously on sources, that God interacts with the world through two different channels. One he calls Hanhagas HaMishpat, which means tit for tat. It means reward and punishment. You do something, you get rewarded. You do something bad, you get a punishment. God works with you. Now you have to realize that whole system of reward and punishment, on the one hand, it obligates us, but on the other hand, it's a very big blessing because it means that God is interacting with us. He cares, right? I oftentimes unsuccessfully try to convince my children, as I'm sure many of us have been in this situation, that I'm actually punishing you because it's better for you, because I care. And you know what? If I didn't care, so I really wouldn't love you then. I wouldn't really love you if I let you do whatever you want. So as we know, we know that when we're older, we don't really recognize that always when we're kids. But that's a tremendous love of God that he interacts with us. There's another concurrent interaction in the world, another system that he calls Hanhagas HaYichud. What does that mean? That means that the world is working towards an eventual revelation of God's glory. It's something that we daven for every day in Aleinu. We ask that the whole world should recognize God's glory, his unity. You know, it's one of these, in Jewish thought, there's a concept that the world is, you read that Hadoros, the world is going down, but at the same time, we know that the world is progressing. Rav Kook writes often about this great progression, that the world is moving towards the revelation of God in the world where everyone recognizes God. So God is slowly revealing himself. So he writes that sometimes God does things in the world because of the first system, mishpat, reward and punishment. But sometimes God does things in the world because he is trying to move the world towards this ultimate and eventual revelation of his glory. And that is called his interaction of yichud, trying to bring the ultimate unity to the world. And he gets involved in the world through this process of yichud. So, says the Ramchal, he wants to suggest as follows. Everything, and when the Hasidim write that everything is subject to divine providence, what they mean is that every single item in existence is part of this master plan that's moving the world towards Yichud, towards the revelation of God's ultimate glory in the world, an ultimate revelation. And therefore, everything, animals, inanimate objects, all of those different things that he created, God didn't create anything for naught. Everything he created has some role to play in this process of yichud. But mankind is interacted with differently. Mankind is interacted, schar v'onesh, reward and punishment. God doesn't do something to a cow because it sinned, but God does do things to cows because the cows play an important role in the process of revelation. And therefore, he argues that no one's arguing here. They're just speaking about different things. When the Rambam says divine providence is only for humans, He means divine providence in the sense of reward and punishment. But when the Hasidim and the Kabbalists speak about God's interaction with everything in the world, what they're referring to is this ultimate process of God bringing the world towards its ultimate revelation of His glory. And for that, everything has a role to play. This perspective, where they're not really arguing, they're speaking about different processes that are concurrently going on at the same time, it actually, I think, puts a tremendous amount of meaning into our lives. Because if you remember, I quoted to you that the Rambam and the Ramban and others say that people get different levels of divine providence, depending on how much they're committed to the mission. So what would that mean if I'm a human being and I'm not so committed? So I lose my divine providence. Well, I can't lose it less than the cows and the rocks. I'm no worse than the inanimate objects. What it means is that we are in a state of flux. How much are we like everything else in creation? And we're important, just like everything in creation. And we're all part of this process of bringing the world to its ultimate revelation. And how much are we central players in that process? That the actions that we do, God responds directly, reward and punishment, because we're central players. I don't know how many people are basketball players here. But the muscle that I always think of, the analogy I always think of, is that sometimes, if you ever watch a basketball game, sometimes there's the star player, and all of the moves on the court and all the plays on the court are to get him the ball. But in order to do that, you have a lot of other players that play important roles. Now, ultimately, it's to get the ball in the hands of the player that you want to take the shot. You know, sometimes you might even take out the best player and put someone else in because the coach wants to speak to the best player. So the guy on the bench is actually getting his time in the game. He's getting the focus of the coach, but not because of him, but because he plays an important role in the process of winning the game. And I think that mankind, to the degree that we're dedicated to God's mission in the world, to spread His mission, to learn Torah, to do chesed, to daven, to reach out to the broader community, to the degree that we represent, I always tell the guys that our goal, and especially on this trip, because we've gone to a lot of Jewish communities, but we've also, you know, traveling and staying in holiday inns in the middle of North Carolina, we've had a lot of interaction with the broader community, not the broader Jewish community, you know, the broader community of America. And it's an opportunity, especially those of us, I live in Israel, so I don't get much interaction with the Gentile world. And the boys here who live in their communities in New York and Los Angeles, also, they don't often, you know, maybe in Target they see people. But here, you know, we spent a lot of time. We hiked in Shenandoah. We spent a lot of time hiking on trails with people. And I said to the guys that our job is to be ambassadors of Hashem and to speak to people and to reach out to people. So to the degree that we're doing that, Hashem moves us into Hanhagas HaMishpa. He moves us into that central role. And to the degree that we don't take up that mission, so we slide a little bit into the background. We still get divine providence, but it's more now as being part of the stage, of being part of the general process of moving things towards the ultimate glory. So we haven't been able to answer the question, did I stub my toe today because this is, because I did, you know, because I kicked my little brother yesterday, so now God got me back and I stubbed my toe. So that, I can't answer that question. But at least we got some initial thoughts, some things to think about. I thank you very much for your time. And as I said, for me personally, it's a big honor to be here and to be able to express my Hakaras HaTov to the building and to all those who have been in the building. And we thank you very much for your time. We hope to join you for Shacharis tomorrow morning. We're gonna learn in the shul in the morning. Anyone's welcome to join us if you'd like to. We'll be here in the morning hours tomorrow to learn a little bit in the